Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. This is such an interesting portion of Scripture. You know it by heart. The problem with things that we know, I've said this before, but I say it again, the problem with things that we know that we're familiar with is that sometimes we think we know the whole story. We think we know everything there is to know about it. Or we say, I've heard that since I was in Sunday school. The story that we're going to read this morning, you probably have heard since you were in Sunday school, but I'm not sure you've always heard it correctly. I think there's been a lot of romanticizing by well-meaning pastors and teachers, Sunday school teachers, about David and Goliath. And this morning, I'm not going to try to just repeat the same old phrases, but I learned some new things as I studied and researched this from gifted and godly scholars. And I want to share those with you this morning. Now, I want to start reading in 1 Samuel chapter 17. I'm going to read quite a bit of length of Scripture, which I don't particularly always like to do in a mixed gathering or in a gathering, because sometimes people say, my goodness. But start at verse 12 of 1 Samuel 17, and I think I'm going to read it because I want to refer back. Now, David was the son of a man named Jesse, an Ephrathite from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. Jesse was an old man at that time, and he had 8 sons. Jesse's 3 oldest sons, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shimeah, had already joined Saul's army to fight the Philistines. And I think if you had any one of those 3 names, you'd be ready to fight just because somebody named you that. Who wants a name? Abinadab. What's your name? Abinadab. What's your name? Shimeah. Well, those are fighting words right there. But they had gone to join Saul's army to fight the Philistines. David was the youngest son. David's 3 older brothers stayed with Saul's army. But David went back and forth so he could help his father with the sheep in Bethlehem. And so already prior to this time, he has been playing the harp for Saul. People sometimes say, well, I thought he was just out there taking care of the sheep and this is the first time he ever met Saul. No, it's not. It says he went back and forth so he could help his father with the sheep. And when it means back and forth, it means from Saul's presence. And we could read about that if we had further time. For 40 days every morning, now it goes directly to the battle. For 40 days every morning and evening, the Philistine champion strutted in front of the Israelite army. One day, Jesse said to David, take this basket of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread and carry them quickly to your brothers and give these 10 cuts of cheese to their captain. See how your brothers are getting along. Bring me back a report of how they're doing. David's brothers were with Saul and the Israelite army at the Valley of Elah fighting against the Philistines. It kind of sets that up again. So David left the sheep with another shepherd and set out early the next morning with the gifts as Jesse had directed him. He arrived at the camp just as the Israelite army was leaving for the battlefield with shouts and battle cries. And you're going to find out this was all hat and no cattle. These guys were scared out of their boots. But they made a big talk doesn't win many battles. Soon, the Israelites and Philistines stood facing each other, army against army. There's probably 400, 500, 600 yards in between them here and this big valley. You've got to kind of picture this in your mind, that probably 400, 500, 600 yards, they could hear one another across there because of the acoustics were good, but they were not within bow range or sword range, anything like that. They stood facing each other. Verse 22, David left the things with the keeper of the supplies. He's just gotten there. And he hurried out to the ranks to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came out from the Philistine ranks. Then David heard him shout his usual taunts to the army of Israel. Verse 24, as soon as the Israelite army saw him, they began to run away in fright. That's a little different down here, isn't it? Where it says they were leaving with shouts and battle cries. In other words, they're like a team in the locker room. Yo, yo. Have you ever played sports and heard teams in the locker room? You can hear them clear out on the field. But it doesn't take long before when they face off, you can find out that one team didn't mean it. They were just going through the routine. And the team that meant it, they came out to play football or basketball, whatever. But these guys now, they heard him, they came out. Then David heard him shout his usual taunt to the army of the Philistines. As soon as the Israelite army saw it, they began to run away. Have you seen the giant, the men asked. He comes out each day to defy Israel. The king has offered a huge reward to anyone who kills him. He will give that man one of his daughters for a wife, and the man's entire family will be exempted from paying taxes. David asked the soldier standing nearby, what will a man get for killing this Philistine and ending his defiance of Israel? Who is this pagan Philistine anyway that he is allowed to defy the armies of the living God? And these men gave David the same reply. They said, yes, that's the reward for killing him. But when David's oldest brother, Eliab, heard David talking to the men, he was angry. What are you doing around here? He said. What about those few sheep you're supposed to be taking care of? I know your pride and deceit. You just want to see the battle. What have I done now? David replied. In other words, all I'm doing is asking questions. Why are you after me? But it's like the older brother against the younger brother. He walked over to some others and asked them the same thing. He wasn't at all put off by his older brother. He told him, you mind your business, I'll mind mine. Then David's question was reported to King Saul, and the king sent for him. Verse 32, don't worry about this Philistine, David told Saul. I'll go fight him. Don't be ridiculous, Saul replied. There's no way you can fight this Philistine and possibly win. You're only a boy. And by the way, that word boy in the Hebrew is translated young man. It can refer to anybody up to 30 years of age. If you've ever seen these little pictures in Sunday school rooms, and here's a little guy out there 12, 13 years old, that's not true. That's not the case at all. This is not a 12-year-old boy, a 13-year-old boy. He's probably in his 16, 17, 18. He's much older than a little boy out there with a little sling going on. So when it says you're just a boy, and he's been a man of war since his youth. In other words, he's fought more than you've been alive. He's been in the army more than years you've even been alive. But David said, I've been taking care of my father's sheep and goats. He said, when a lion or a bear comes to steal a lamb from the flock, I go after it with a club. Whoa, doesn't sound like any 12 or 13-year-old boy, does it? If he did, he wouldn't live too long. A lion, a bear, I go after it with a club and rescue the lamb from its mouth. And if the animal turns on me, I catch it by the jaw and club it to death. Now, that's what you call pure bravery. I've done this to both lions and bears, and I'll do it to this pagan Philistine too, for he has defied the armies of the living God. Notice his testimony. It's good for us to give testimony. That's what we affirm what God's done. The Lord who rescued me from the claws of the lion and the bear will rescue me from this Philistine. Saul finally consented. All right, go ahead, he said, and may the Lord be with you. The reason he gave such ready consent was he didn't want to go out himself, which... he's the biggest man among them. Remember, he was elected king because he was head and shoulders above everybody. So he's the most likely candidate to go out. But he didn't go out, and there's a reason for it. You want to look back in chapter 16. Let's see if I can find it. Chapter 16, verse 14. You'll find out why he didn't want to go back. Now out to fight. Now the Spirit of the Lord had left Saul, and the Lord had sent a tormenting spirit that filled him with depression and fear. Whenever the Spirit of God departs from a person, you no longer are a brave person. Our strength is in the Lord, and our confidence is in the Lord. And Saul didn't want to go out as he had done previously. He was no slouch. He had led to people numerous times, but he didn't want to go out because he's scared that God's not with him, and he knows it. All right? Let's go back and finish this chapter now, and then we'll get into the lesson. All right, go ahead. Verse 38. Then Saul gave David his own armor, a bronze helmet and a coat of mail. David put it on, strapped the sword over it, and took a step or two to see what it was like, for he had never worn such things before. I can't go out in these, he protested to Saul. I'm not used to them. So David took them off again. He picked up 5 smooth stones from a stream and put them into his shepherd's bag, and then armed only with his shepherd's staff and sling, he started across the valley to fight the Philistines. Goliath walked out towards David with his shield bearer ahead of him, sneering in contempt at this ruddy-faced boy, again, young man. "Am I a dog?" he roared at David, "that you come at me with a stick?" And he cursed David by the name of his gods. "Come over here and I'll give your flesh to the birds and wild animals," Goliath yelled. David replied to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, spear, and javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today the Lord will conquer you, and I will kill you and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of your young men to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And everyone assembled here will know that the Lord rescues his people, but not with sword and spear. This is the Lord's battle, and he will give you to us." As Goliath moved closer to attack David, David quickly ran out to meet him. Reaching into his shepherd's bag and taking out a stone, he hurled it with a sling and hit the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank in, and Goliath stumbled and fell to the ground. So David triumphed over the Philistine with only a sling and a stone, for he had no sword. Then David ran over, pulled out Goliath's sword from its sheath. David used it to kill him and cut off his head. So that's the quick reading of this story that every one of us has heard at times, if you've been in church, from our earliest days of David and Goliath. This morning now, we're going to notice a few things here. I'll try to read most of this to stay with it in the length of time that we have. As the mist cleared from the valley, the men on both sides knew that the time had come. Before this day was done, many men would die. The soldiers of the army of Israel checked their weapons to make sure that they were ready. They grabbed a quick bite of bread and cheese. Other older soldiers perhaps took a swig of wine from the flask and spit it out. They had the hardened look of men who knew what was to come. The younger ones were quiet. All the bragging of the night before was gone. They were too scared to tell jokes and too afraid and ashamed to admit their fear. As they looked out across the valley of Elah, they saw on the other side the mass of men that they would soon meet in battle. The Israelites on one slope, the Philistines on the other side. In between them was a valley, and this valley was a ravine that had a dry creek bed that spread out several hundred yards. Soon that creek bed would be a battlefield flowing with human blood. And the story begins that we started there in 17. They gathered their forces. You can see it in verses 1 through 3. They gathered their forces for war and assembled at Socah. David and the Israelites on one side and the Philistines on the other side. Before we go on, it would be interesting to know that this was the second battle between the Philistines and the Israelites. They were mortal enemies. But this was the second battle within a relatively short length of time. And the first battle, the Israelites had given it to them at the battle of what is called Michmash. You can read about it three chapters earlier. We won't read about it, but in 1 Samuel 13, chapters 13 and 14, the Israelites had dealt a stinging defeat to the Philistines. And now it was time for the Philistines, who were the superior force by far, to get even. They were going to pay back these Israelites with interest. Now, I want you first of all to notice number one here, and you can put in there the challenge. The challenge. This word is not given because a strange thing happens for them to go down. The Philistines are not coming down the slope. They aren't coming. They're standing over there. And at first, the men of Israel think they might have won by forfeit. They're not going to come. Maybe they're scared. Maybe they're running away. But before they can celebrate, a strange sight unfolds that actually unnerves them, the likes of which they have never seen before. Someone is moving down that slope. He's huge. He's the biggest person that any of them have ever seen in their life. He's covered with glittering bronze. Now picture this in your mind. This huge giant is walking down. The Philistine army is amassed, thousands upon thousands, and out of the ranks comes this huge guy. He's a massive hunk of a man, and he's got bronze from toe to head. And the Bible tells us that he is as big as any man. They've never seen anything like him. He stands 6 cubits and a span. Now, that doesn't mean anything to us, but I read several translations to make this accurate because I've seen lots of guesstimates about this was. But even the Bible translated here, he's not over 9 feet tall. In fact, 6 cubits in a span would be 9 feet 9. We have some big dudes today in professional basketball. 7 foot 2, 7 foot 3. I think the biggest one I've ever heard is 7 foot 6. I've never seen anybody 9 foot 9. That's as high as what a good man can jump. And this guy is huge. You just got to picture this here. His name, of course, is Goliath. To show you, not only is he big, but he's powerful. His armor weighs 125 pounds. Now, some of you, I used to be able to, I don't think I could anything more, can lift 125 pounds. Some of you can lift a lot more than that. But can you imagine trying to wage battle with armor that weighs 125 pounds strapped on you? You strap that on the normal guy, and he couldn't hardly move. He wouldn't even be able to do anything. And he wore bronze shin guards, and he had a bronze javelin slung over his back. And his spear, the Bible said, the spear that he had was as big around as a man's arm, and the spear head weighed 17 pounds. Now think about this. Most of us would be going around out there in the battlefield trying to hold the spear up. This guy's spear head weighs 17 pounds. And ahead of him, in front of him, marches a soldier carrying a shield, one soldier, large enough to protect his entire body. He didn't pick that up until he was ready to fight, because it probably weighed 50, 60, 70 pounds in addition. Big bronze shield. And this other guy just carried it for him until he was ready to use it so he wouldn't be worried. Now, you still got this picture? Having gotten their attention, which wasn't hard when you see something like that step out, keep in mind that the average Israelite at this time, by the way, Israelites are not large people. They're 5'6", 5'7", 5'8". So here you are, 5'6", 7'8", probably 25 years of age. You've got a wife and 3 children at home, and this guy says, come on out and fight me. This was the way they did a lot of times to prevent unnecessarily bloodshed. Armies would line up, and you would send out one man, and they would fight to the death and winner take all. And then the other army would surrender to that army, and sometimes it saved massive bloodshed. Now, that's what Goliath is doing here. That's the practice of the calling out. Send out one man, I'll send out, you send out one man, I'm the one man over here, we'll fight to the death, and if I win, you surrender to us. If you win, our entire Philistine army will surrender to you. We'll find out later that that was all talk also. Now, this fearsome giant of a man had stopped the army of God, the Israelites, the army of God. He had stopped them in their tracks for 40 days and nights. Think about this. Every morning, this big hunk, 9 foot 9, comes out massively prepared and cusses them. He just shouts taunts at them. He ridicules them. He calls them all kinds of names, trying to get them to taunt it, to send out one man. And they're all scared to death. They're not about to go out there because they know that it is pure suicide. They stood paralyzed by fear, thinking only of how much bigger Goliath was in his strength than they were in their strength. Now, I want to make some applications as we go along. I don't know if I put all of this in your notes or not. But we all have giants in our life. I want you to think of Goliath as a giant that you're facing. Some obstacle, some problem that seems greater than you. Some addiction, some situation, some weakness in your life. Whatever it can be. I want you to think now of the analogy between this. It only takes one Goliath, one giant, to stop you as long as you look at that giant from the human level. The Israelites were stopped in their tracks because they were not looking at this thing from God's perspective. They were looking at it from a human perspective, and that told them, common sense says, he'll kill us within the first 30 seconds. We won't even be able to get within range. He's got a long arm and a long spear. He'll cut us right in half. When Goliath says, am I not a Philistine, in verse 8, that we, I don't know if I started there. Yeah, Goliath stood and shouted across, are you not coming out to fight? He called, I am the Philistine champion, but you are only the servants of Saul. When he says, am I not a Philistine, actually that's better translated, am I not the Philistine? I'm the man. I'm the defender over here. I am the one that defies you and your God, whoever he is. This is pure cynicism and ridicule on his part. And the Bible tells us in verse 11, look in verse 11 there and you'll see. When Saul and the Israelites heard this, they were terrified and deeply shaken. Even Saul was terrified, and I've already told you why he was terrified. The Bible tells us in that chapter 16, the Spirit of God had left him, and so he no longer is the brave soldier. He's no longer the brave leader of the children of Israel that he once was. Now he is frightened, and of course, fear is contagious. And so the challenge goes unmet. Goliath goes back to his camp, but it's not over. Verse 16 tells us he did this 40 days straight, twice a day, morning and evening, to challenge the men of Israel. And each day it was the same. No one would answer the challenge. You see, God's people were losing the battle before it even started. I can picture in my mind's eye that the children of Israel, they got the soldiers, the battle leaders, got together every night and tried to formulate a plan. What are we going to do? I'm sure they talked strategy and tactics. Saul was there along with Big Abner, his commander-in-chief, his general, and the other top brass. Maybe they even set up a mock battlefield to try to simulate this in their minds as to what could they do. Here's one mound of dirt over here and another mound of dirt over here, and they'd fashion this out. What can we do? They tried to strategize. But here now is where we get to some more application. At ground level, giants can unglue us. And we can't go on. The problem, here is the problem right here with anything that's in your life or mine. The problem is not how big the giant is. The problem is how small and powerless the giant makes us feel. If it's an addiction, if it's a fear, If it's an enemy, if it's somebody we don't like, we know what we should do, but we're scared. What if? What if? What if? So it's really not the size of the giant, whatever he or it is, it's how powerless it makes us feel in our own strength. So we have the challenge. Here now is the hero. Enter David, the hero of the story. But when we meet David, he's not the hero. He's the grocery boy. He's the Subway delivery boy on a donkey. Really. He's the teenager tending the family sheep at Bethlehem while his three oldest brothers are off at battle. And his father calls him. Over here in verse 17, this is where we get the delivery boy. He's taken almost, as it were, sandwiches to the guys at the front. Verse 17, one day Jesse said, take this basket of roasted grain, kind of like granola. I used to like granola, can't eat it anymore, it gives me terrible heartburn, but I don't know what it did with these guys. Take this basket of roasted grain and these 10 loaves of bread and carry them quickly to your brothers and give these 10 heads of cheese to their captain. So in essence, here's David, he's going down, it's 18 miles away, by the way, from where he is. He's sending him down there, and if you study this out in down here, this roasted grain, this granola that he's taking there is actually 5 gallons. So you probably aren't packing that along with 20 loaves of bread and big heads of cheese. You've got a donkey. So this is where I say David is a Subway boy. He's delivering, but it's on a donkey. With a donkey. And so here we find he's the hero. He's going down there, but it's going to take, there's no guarantee. You remember Domino's has got this thing, takes longer than 30 minutes, you get your pizza free. Well, this is not a guaranteed delivery. It's going to take longer than 30 minutes to get down there. It's 18 miles. So he gets there just as Goliath is coming out in the early morning for the 40th time. You would think this would be old hat, but David is seeing it for the first time. And he's standing there looking at this like they are, but he's seeing it through his own eyes the first time. All right? It's old stuff by now. Verse 23 says, Goliath, look in verse 23 there, and you'll see this. It says, as he was talking with his brothers, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came out from the Philistine ranks. Then David heard him shout his usual taunt to the army of Israel. First time. I think David's looking like, whoa, I've never seen anybody this big. I think that had to, I don't think he's not aware of, look at the size of this guy. I've never seen anything this big. And so he's standing there, and he gets there just as Goliath. David was no match for Goliath. But when that uncircumcised Philistine started blaspheming God, he got in over his head real fast with David. David hasn't heard a thing about Goliath and his challenge. He's just excited to be on the battlefield away from those old smelly sheep for a while. So he says, what's going on? And somebody says, look at verse 25. Well, let me just read it to you rather than that. What's going on down here? And they said, have you seen the giant? Well, not till just now. He's big. He comes out to defy Israel. The king has offered a huge reward to anyone who kills him. Well, I would guess so. He will give that man one of his daughters for a wife, and the man's entire family will be exempted from paying taxes. Do you see that there? And do you get that there? Do you see that there's something there that he comes out? This is a pretty good deal. Except when it says he'll give one of his daughters, he's talking about Michael, and she's no prize, as it goes on here to tell us later. But it's the key to the whole story. What will be done for this man who kills the Philistine, this Philistine, and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? This is David now, that he is allowed to defy the armies, not of Israel, but the armies of the living God. Do you see the zeal and the commitment David had to God? That's why when we see the things going on in America today, if you don't have a righteous anger in your heart, you need to question where your loyalties are. When we see, and they call it political correctness and liberal inclusion and all of that monkey business, but I'm telling you right from the Word of God, when God says no and people say go, God's going to win in the end. And I can assure you, when David saw this man and he's sneering at them, but even beyond sneering at them, he says, why, your God isn't any God. You don't even have a God. You're scared. Otherwise, you'd come out and fight. And David says, you're right. You're right. We would go out and fight. Now, the soldiers are saying, do you see that guy? He's like a mountain. You won't last 5 seconds with him. But David sees him. And this is what I wanted to get to you about whatever issue you're facing, whatever challenge it is. It might not be an enemy. It might just be the biggest challenge of your life. David saw that Goliath was not only defying Israel, he was defying Israel's God, and he wasn't going to stand for it. He saw, here's the key for every one of us today, every one of us, whether we're old or whether you're a collegian, he saw things from God's point of view, not from the world's point of view. You and I need to maintain the divine perspective. David was no match for Goliath, but when that uncircumcised Philistine took on God, he got in over his head, as I said a while ago. This is not braggadocio. This is not big talk. This is a man... who is looking at Goliath, but he's not looking at him horizontally, man to man, or he'd be looking like this. He's looking at him from above. I one time, years ago, saw Shaquille O'Neal play basketball when he was first starting. He played in Rapid City, believe it or not, when he was playing. They had an exhibition game there preseason. And when he came out on the floor, I thought, how would you guard something like that? How would you guard? I mean, the guy's 7'3" tall and about 6 feet wide. And I thought, how would you? He was just so big, he'd get the ball and he'd just start backing up, backing up, backing up. Keep an eye on the basket. Pretty soon, just turn around, drop it in. And I thought, how would an ordinary man confront that? They didn't do very well confronting him by that way that night. He finally got in foul trouble and he didn't get to play the last half because he was so, at that point, he was really rough and rugged and he wasn't getting the breaks that he got later on as a pro. They wanted to keep him in because of people coming to see him. So he got a lot of breaks later on. But the point of it, he was a good basketball player. But the point of it is, if you looked at him from the ground level, if you look at Shaquille O'Neal from ground level, he's big. But if you went up to the top of Sears Tower and looked down, it would make you sick to look down from there. But if you look down, you'd need binoculars to pick out Shaquille O'Neal down there because you're looking at him from above. You're looking at him from, as it were, God's point of view. And that's one of the things that we need to keep in mind. When God is in his right place, Goliath shrinks down to proper size. When Goliath replaces God, that giant, that excuse, I can't do it, I don't want to do it, whatever excuse you use to harbor or to stand in fear of your giant, or even to stand in complicity with your giant, it won't work. So we have the challenge, then we have the hero who doesn't know he's a hero yet. He's just the subway delivery boy on a donkey at this point. Now we have the doubters. Oh, there's always going to be the doubters. Every church has them. Every university has them. You kids that are in college, you're going to have university professors that scoff at God. They're just going to think you're the dumbest thing that they have seen. And they're going to tell you, and they'll have their logic, and they'll try to intimidate you with their academic prowess and intellectual acumen and their articulation and all of their focus and concentrations and education. They'll try to impress you with that. There'll be the doubters. Why have you come down here? The first doubter is amazing. Is Eliab, his own brother, the big brother. You know what? Since he's the biggest brother next to Saul, he's probably the biggest man around because it says he was a big guy. He's really mad at David coming down there and say, why doesn't somebody go out and fight him? Because obviously if you're looking at somebody 9'9" tall, you're looking for somebody else that's big to fight. You're not going to pick out the runt and say, what do you think? You're looking for the next biggest, strongest man, and that's Eliab. But he's scared out of his boots. And he's mad at David for saying, why doesn't somebody go out and fight him? And he's looking probably right at Eliab, and Eliab said, you should be back home taking care of those sheep. What are you doing down here anyhow? We don't like it when somebody exposes our cowardice or our sinfulness. We don't like that. Eliab was angry with David because he was exposing his cowardice above that of his brothers and above the rest of the army. Now, why did he do that? That's what he says in verse 28. Do you see that there? When David's oldest brother, Eliab, heard David talking, he was angry. What are you doing around here? He said, you just come down here to see the battle. You're just a little hanger-on, so to speak. But behind those words lies, well, let me read the words, then David's answer. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be just like one of them. Now that sounds like big talk. But notice why David is saying this. He's not saying this out of a physical strength. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them. Because why am I going to kill him? Because he's defied the armies of the living God. Man, I love that. I love that. There's no. I'm a pretty good shot with a sling, you know. No. He says, somebody's got to do something because God's honor is at stake here. And there is one point I want to make from all the Sunday school lessons I've ever heard. Trying to keep this from just the trite phrases that we've always heard. Look how big he is, yes, but look how much smaller he is than God and all that stuff. But here is something here. The reason David was willing to go out in public to face Goliath was he had faced down the Goliaths privately in his life before. The Goliath of the bear. The Goliath of the lion. Hungry. Coming to keep one of his sheep. He gets out. He says, no. I'm in charge of the sheep. And you're a sheep stealer. And after him it goes. And, I mean, this is incredible if you think about it. I mean, if you think about it, this is incredible. But here's the key. You will never be in public any braver than you are and more faithful than you are in private. That's why, Susie, when we stand up to confess, that's for all of us. Well, if you're a preacher, it's not hard because people expect you to. They expect you to say the right things. And, you know, if you're ashamed as a preacher, you know, you get another one because you don't want a preacher running around that's scared to give his testimony. But it's hard for the average person to speak up. But I want to tell you something. If you're faithful to God in your personal life, you will not be ashamed of him in your public life. If you deal with the giant of the bear and the lion that come to attack you or to attack something dear to you, and you deal with them privately, you'll be able to stand for God publicly. Not as a, oh, look at me, how strong, how brave, how big I am. No. But you're standing there because your faith is in God and he's been faithful to you privately. Therefore, he's going to see you through this situation. Now, so there's the doubters. Here's a big word. I don't know if I put it in here or not. Yeah, I did. Here it is in number 3. Every giant in your path is also in God's path if you are going God's direction. Does that make sense to you? If there's a giant in your path and you and God are walking together, and there's a giant in your path, then that giant is also in God's path. And what that means is, if you are in the will of God, the giants who are fighting you are actually fighting against God. That's why the Bible says we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. So if we run, now here's a question then. If we're in the will of God, then why does God allow giants? I think for two things. First, to see if we'll run or fight. And secondly, to allow us an opportunity to honor him. Let's go to number 4 now, the battle. Here is where it gets interesting. Off he goes to the battle. We read, so we won't reread all of the previous verses. Saul tries to get him to use his armor. That's why, and David said, I've never worn these things in my life, man. I can't do this. You and I cannot live on somebody else's experience. We've heard preachers say that for 1,000 years. David said, I can't take your armor, Saul. I don't even know. I don't know anything about it. So you cannot live, if you're a teenager or a young person, or even at my age, if your parents are still living, you cannot live off of the faith of your parents or grandparents. In fact, somebody has really said this, and it's kind of, you have to think about it. God has no grandchildren. They're all children. In other words, there are no second generations. They're all first generations. God doesn't have any. Somebody comes in, well, I belong to the Lord, therefore, my grandchildren or my children belong to the Lord. No, everybody has to make their own decision. God doesn't have any grandchildren. They're either all children or not. You follow that? So here's the thing now. He heads down to battle, and he pauses at the creek bed to pick up 5 smooth stones. And this is the part that I want to just elaborate a little bit on. We tend to romanticize this, or we've heard it romanticized, I think, from well-meaning people. You know, and you know this part of it, but I just had this illuminated to me recently again by a pastor who was over in Israel, who was witnessing firsthand this situation of men using their sling. Sometimes we picture a slingshot as this little thing on a, you know, like a little fork off of a tree. And even if these, it's got a rubber band, you pick up a little rock or you put a marble in there and you boom, 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 you know, and you pull it back like that. And we all know, without elaboration much, this wasn't that type of a sling. The slings that they had over there, and I wish I had one to show you. I've seen them. They're about that long. Two pieces of leather, probably as big around as your finger, pure leather, and then they've got a pouch in them. Those two pieces of leather are tied to a pouch. It's a big pouch, as big as a man's hand and maybe half again as big. It's that big. That's how big the pouch is. It's probably 5-6 inches wide and 5-7 inches long. And it's simply, and it's supple leather. It's real supple. And they pick this, and they put a rock in there. The guy that was telling me about this said, I've never seen anything like it in my life. He said there was two or three shepherds, just like here, and they were having a little recreational fun, just like guys go out and plink at prairie dogs and stuff like that nowadays with their rifles. These guys, they were on a tour bus, and they stopped, and these two or three guys now know they've got an audience, so now they're really into it, you know. And they've got a whole host of rocks laying there at their feet. And the pastor that told me that, he said, man, they weren't little rocks. He said they were as big as tennis balls. And he said some of them were even bigger than that. Solid rock, perfectly round. And they would put that in that pouch, and they had a target off. He said, I know, Larry, I know that it had to be 100 yards. And he said, that was so heavy that you just don't start going like this because you can't get it going. So you kind of rock it to get it going. You just rock it. Because, you know, the thing, I don't know how much a solid rock, but you don't just do that, but you get it going like this. And then when you get that in there like this, and he said they would whirl that around like a world champion discus thrower. He said they would whirl that thing around, and it's going around and around. And he told me this. They've got it kind of, they've got two fingers and a thumb. They've got a place where it's got a curl. And then these other two fingers are the trigger. And they get that thing just going around and around. And keep in mind, it's out there like 4 feet, just going around and around and around and around. And then they let it go. And he said they were shooting at a piece of white chalk that was in a creek bank across the creek. He said, I know it had to be 100 yards. And he said, I watched, and 8 times out of 10, they hit that white mark 100 yards away. And he said, I know, Larry, it wasn't any bigger than a foot square. And these were three different shepherds. They have said that when that's released, that it comes out of there at over 100 miles an hour. You say, is that possible? Well, I think it is. If a guy can, Josh Beckett can throw, you know, there's guys that can throw fastballs in baseball, 100, 101, 103, 4 miles an hour. And so if you've got this thing and that comes out of there, can you see why if somebody has a round rock and it comes out of a sling and you're 15 yards away and it comes out of there at 100 miles an hour and it smacks you in the head? It doesn't matter if you're Goliath or if you're a midget, you're going down. In fact, it just didn't knock him out. It probably penetrated his skull. It actually, at that speed, at that distance, it probably penetrated clear into his skull. Bonehead or not, he met his match when that rock got there. And so the battle is this. I put this in here, and I'll probably repeat it again. David's coming near to Goliath. Behind his shoulder, the whole army is watching. Go get him, David. Go get him. Go get him. You can do it, David. Isn't it amazing how we can cheer for somebody when we're scared to do it? But we go get him. Go get him. Another fellow from the Philistine army starts taking bets on how long this is going to last. But here's a thought for your contemplation, and I put it in there. I hope you never forget this. Don't tell God how big your giants are. He already knows, right? Tell your giants how big your God is. That's what David was doing here. He wasn't saying like, oh, Lord, Lord, do you see? He's huge. If you start telling and rehearsing how big your giants are, now that we bring our stuff to the Lord, don't misunderstand me at this point. You bring your problem to the Lord, but you face your problem and tell your problem, whatever the situation is, you say, as David did here to Goliath. David isn't telling God how big Goliath is. He's telling Goliath how big God is. Do you see the entire difference? We can almost paralyze ourselves by rehearsing our sicknesses, our weaknesses, our illnesses, our problems, our addictions. I'm not talking about rationalizing or minimizing them, but I'm talking about speaking to them in faith through the power of Jesus Christ, who has all power and can deliver us from them and over them, whatever it is. So don't dwell on telling God how big your problem is. You should bring it to him and say, Lord, it's bigger than me. But speak to your giant and say, you have harassed me, you have intimidated me, you have subjected me, you have kept me guilty, you've kept me in fear, you've kept me in bondage, but I rebuke you in Jesus' name through the power of the cross and the blood of Christ. I claim victory over you. You shall not vanquish me because I serve a greater God. I tell you, friends, if you throw in the towel on any situation in your life, and you say, I can't do it, what you're saying is, my problem is bigger than God's provision. Is that not true? If you quit, if you say, I can't do this, you're saying, my problem is bigger than God's provision. And that's a faithless statement. Because the Bible says in Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. So now let's press on. We got about 6-7 minutes left. Press on here. So we move from the battle. He smushed him. He served up an ace. 100 mile an hour tennis ball ace. Boom. Penetrated his skull without a doubt. The only place he could have hit him. You say, are you sure he could do that? I was going to look it up and I forgot. But in the Bible somewhere it talks about David had a whole army of left-handed men. They were left-handed, by the way. I don't know why they were left-handed. Who could do anything with a left hand? They could throw, it says, they could throw a stone within a hand's breadth. In other words, within 4 inches at a distance. It talks about, I should have looked it up, the reference. It's amazing. These were men that practiced, that were professionals, that got skill. David was a professional. By the way, I want to confirm to you again what I said earlier, lest you think, well, where'd you get this idea that David is just a little, you know, that he's not just a little boy? Turn back to chapter 16, verse 18. After the Spirit of God had departed from Saul, some of Saul's servants said in verse 15, 16, 15, chapter 16, verse 15, some of Saul's servants said to him, a tormenting spirit from God's troubling you. Let's find a good musician to play the harp whenever the tormenting spirits come. He will play music and you will soon be well again. All right, Saul said, find me someone who plays well and bring him here. One of servants said to Saul, one of Jesse's sons from Bethlehem is a talented harp player. Not only that, he is a brave warrior. Not only that, he is a man of war. In other words, he's mature. And he has good judgment. So you see, David's reputation, this, it's not like I said, he had been playing for Saul before chapter 17. Now, why didn't Saul recognize him then? Because oftentimes in those days, you didn't even, if you played the night music, so to speak, you were behind a curtain. Like, have you seen this like in funeral homes or so forth, where the singer or the one who sings or plays is behind a deal? You don't even see the singer. It was that way where I pastored before. You'd hear this beautiful voice coming, but the beautiful voice was behind a shield of boards. You never saw who was singing because they wanted the emphasis to be on what was sung. And so this is not, like I say, some 12-year-old boy. I just get weary with hearing that because it's not the case at all. Here is a young man who has proven himself over several years, and the fact that he has come and gone back and forth and has related this incident about the sheep and about the bear and the lion, not in a bragging way, but about the fact that this is what God had helped him to do. This is why this guy knew about him. And then he'd been playing for Saul, but Saul didn't even recognize him that day when he came in. And as I said, one of the good reasons is probably he didn't know, because maybe he hadn't even met David face to face. Although that's not the whole point there. Now, let's go to this last one here. What's the applications? What would applications? 4 minutes. I want to ask and answer three questions that we've been through. What would qualify as a giant in your life today? What would qualify under application? What would qualify as a giant in your life today? To answer the basic question, a giant is any situation or any person who blocks your walk with God. He has to be, here's the thing, most of the time you don't defeat Goliath in one great battle. David did here, but most of the time he will come back in another form, in another way. That's what the Bible calls temptation. And so here's something here. I put down David blank Goliath. What do you think the answer is? Killed him? No. Here's going to shock you. David needed Goliath. You say, what? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard in my life. Well, that's pretty good if that's the craziest thing you've ever heard in your life. David needed Goliath. The point is that without Goliath, I mean, here's David. He leaves home as the delivery boy on a donkey for Jimmy John's, taking sandwiches down to his brothers. And by nightfall, he owns the franchise. Pretty good, huh? From delivery boy to I got a chain of these things. David's credibility was established by his willingness to face the giant in his life who was standing between God and him.